and says, I couldn't sell the X. And she replaces the X with like baby aspirin and stuff. Something that will look at least.
She just keeps compounding her bad decisions with worse decisions.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
Wait. You want us to sell Amway?
Confederated Products. It's a different company. It's a different quality of product.
Hello, everybody. This is Recotopia, episode 39. I am Chris Atkinson.
And I'm Jeremy Scott.
And today's big recommend is going to be Go from 1999. Oh. And we are once again doing this live in front of a few people on Twitch and YouTube, and they're out in force today with their comments. And once again, like to acknowledge you guys, because you guys make this fun to record every Tuesday. So
acknowledgements.
Do you have any small recommends, Jeremy?
It's no big deal.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
I got some smalls. The first one I'm gonna go with, I just watched 2 days ago. I watched it recently. It's called The Stranger. It's a 2022 film that co-stars, I'm gonna get the name wrong, Joel Edgerton and Sean Harris. Sean Harris is the villain from the most recent Mission Impossible movies. I'm sure he's probably an award-winning actor for British shit I've never seen. but this is a very Australian movie. I love this poster that you're seeing on screen that splits their faces down the middle. This is a very straightforward, in my opinion, undercover cop friendship drama. You learn very early on, I'm not spoiling you at all, to say that Joel Edgerton is an undercover cop. He was definitely convicted of kidnapping years before that and spent some years in jail for it. But they don't have enough evidence, so he's never been charged with this crime. So Joel Edgerton's job is to become this guy's best friend and get him to eventually fucking admit it. And from there, I didn't think there were a lot of surprises, but I was riveted by the acting. Sean Harris's character is really strange in a gripping way. Just says weird things at weird times, behaves in strange ways. Joel Edgerton plays that undercover cop thing really well, where you can see the strain it's having. It keeps cutting to his vignettes with his son he shares custody of, and it's just like the simple normal father-son stuff, and then it'll cut to a scene of gangster shit with guns and lies, and he basically poses as a mid-level gangster and recruits Sean Harris to work for him. And that's really all I think I need to say about it. It's on Netflix. It came out in September. It's pretty new. It also has, looking at the names, nobody else's name I recognize. those two are great. It's an actor's movie. And I think you will like it if you like both of them guys.
I like both of these actors. Joel Edgerton is one of our most underrated actors that we have, probably. Sean Harris is, he's in a lot of stuff that you didn't realize that you'd seen him in, because he's so different in the Mission Impossible movies. I think it's because he's more clean cut in the Mission Impossible movies, and then everything else, he's got the scraggly beard and all that.
And that's how he is in this movie too. Very scraggly and wired.
Yeah. So you're like when you see him in Mission Impossible, you're like, I've never seen this dude in my life. And then you go and look at his credits, and it's like, oh, I've seen him everywhere, actually, as it turns out. I flipped on HBO Max and I caught See How They Run, the new It's another mystery movie. That's the mystery movies have been huge lately. It's great. It's just one of those things where it's only a matter of time before this all goes and like nobody wants to watch these anymore. But this is a fun one with a fun cast. It starts off with Adrian Brody sort of narrating it for you and telling you. I hate whodunits, basically, is what he says right off the bat. I hate whodunits. And he tells you why he hates whodunits is because it's always the same thing over and over again. They introduce a bunch of characters, and then it's the least likable character that always dies. And then the cop always says, I think I know who it is, and it's the least likely person, and blah, blah, blah. He goes through the whole formula of it. And Adrian Brody is playing a director who is about to do an adaptation of an Agatha Christie called The Mousetrap. And I didn't quite investigate this. I'm not sure if Agatha Christie has ever written anything called The Mousetrap before, but it's an adaptation of something that, you know, in this movie, she's written, and it's like, it's a stage play first. So there's a bunch of actors who are in this stage play who are eventually going to be in the movie. Adrian Brody is hoping to be able to direct this at some point, but there's a stipulation that it must be a play first before it's a movie. Anyway, he goes through this whole thing, and you see Adrian Brody go through. He's still narrating, and he is the least likable person at the beginning of this movie. He gets into it with everybody. He hits on Richard Attenborough's wife. Richard Attenborough is played by Harris Dickinson in this movie. He gets into it with his writer, played by David Oyelowo. His writer wants to go a certain direction, and he does not. So it basically builds a cast of suspects, because Adrian Brody is, of course, going to die at the very beginning of this movie.
Mm.
And so now after his death and the usual list of suspects are there. Sam Rockwell, the experienced detective, comes in to solve the case, and he is sort of saddled with a rookie partner played by Saoirse Ronan, who hasn't even passed her sergeant's exam yet, but she's already being thrust into this case so that she can learn things. And of course she's very dutiful about everything. She wants to accuse everybody that they interrogate of the murder immediately. She takes a lot of notes, and it's like everything they do, she takes notes. And Sam Rockwell, of course, who's the old pro, is like, are you taking notes of everything? And she's like, well, not of everything. And then he goes, well, did you take down the meeting of this and that? And it was something really innocuous. He goes, yes, I did. So you are taking notes of everything. You know? This movie looked very Wes Anderson-y when I saw the trailers for it. And because it's got a lot of people who have been in Wes Anderson movies in it before, but it is not. It is Tom George who did this one. A really fun mystery with a lot of fun actors. And I think that, most people out there who are looking to get their mystery fix in, will enjoy See How They Run. So that's my first small recommend.
All right. Very good. Very good. I am going to skip two of my planned small recommends, save them for later. I'm going to go to the end of my list, production team. I need to share that with everyone, of course. I'm going to go with The Trust. It's a 2016 movie starring Nick Cage and Elijah Wood. It's a 63, I think, on Rotten Tomatoes. And I think that's about right. Mm-hmm. This is one of those Nick Cage plays a really weird character in a movies that's actually enjoyable. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when he goes in his directions, I can't tolerate the film because it's just too much or it doesn't feel authentic. But this is one of these where he's not over the top. He's not doing a lot of screaming, but he's quirky as hell. And he and Elijah Wood are co-workers in the police evidence room in Las Vegas, I think, if I remember right. And Nicolas Cage is curious, and he's looking through arrest logs and bail, and finds that this one low-level drug dealer was bailed out at $200,000 in all cash. And he says to Elijah Wood, that means this guy has a high-level, rich person looking out for him. I'm going to stake out this guy and see if I can learn more. And Elijah Wood is resistant the entire time. Nick Cage discovers that basically through his surveillance, he finds a safe house that's literally has a safe that he thinks is in there that has everything this organization has stolen. Everyone brings their stuff here and it never goes out. And so he wants to raid this place and steal what he thinks is cash from the safe. And that's the beginning of the plan. But once they get to the apartment above the safe house, there are surprises one after another. Elijah Wood is great. But the real joy here is the kind of what's going to happen. And then Nick Cage being weird in a way that's entertaining. I can't tell you it's a fantastic movie, but I really enjoyed watching it. Mm-hmm. It could be that the unbearable weight of massive talent, which I adore, has just given mm-hmm. me a new, deeper well of love for Nick Cage or his weirdness. Yeah. Right. But I had a really good time, and I like movies that don't go where I expect them to. So mm-hmm. Check it out if you want. Let me see if I can tell you where it's at. I think it's on Paramount Plus. Yeah, and then a premium subscription everywhere else, like Sling and Hulu and Amazon Prime.
Okay, yeah.
It's called The Trust.
I mean, that's a collection of actors that I never thought I'd hear before, like Nick Cage,
Sky Ferreira, and Jerry Lewis are also in this movie. So.
Oh, wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Watched Weird, the Al Yankovic Story as well.
Oh, cool!
And I can recommend this pretty wholeheartedly. I think everybody has sort of heard like what this movie is about, because it's not a true biopic. It is essentially fiction. It is essentially a Walk Hard
movie.
But Daniel Radcliffe plays Weird Al Yankovic in this movie. I thought what interesting, they show his early life, and Julianne Nicholson, who played in that Marilyn Monroe thing earlier this month, it also played Marilyn Monroe's mom, is playing Weird Al's mom in this. Toby Huss plays Weird Al's like awful, awful father, who doesn't want him to play the accordion. there's a whole thing at the beginning where he's like, his father's like, you're just going to grow up and you're going to work at the factory where I work. And he's like, and Al's like, what do you guys make at the factory? And everybody who ever gets asked that question is like, what do we make at the factory? What does it matter what we make at the factory? Like, no one ever answers what they make at the factory. So it just goes through, and like, there's a point where like it just gets sillier and sillier as it goes along. Like, a door-to-door salesman comes up, played by Thomas Lennon, comes up to the door and is trying to sell him an accordion. He gets into the house and starts pitching him why he should have an accordion and everything. His father goes into the room as this is happening, catches him in the act of nearly buying an accordion. And, beats the salesman up, and then the mom behind her husband's back, Julianne Nicholson, buys the accordion for Al so that he can play it. And so you're going to have to play it, not when your dad's not around or whatever. He can never know that you're playing the accordion. And then it fast forwards for like another like 5 or 6 years or something, and apparently he's become really good at the accordion because he's been playing in his closet every time, every chance he gets. And there's a party he gets invited to. It's something that if you watch a lot of biopics or any movies at all, you're like, oh, these cool kids are inviting him to a party, and it's going to be one of those things where they embarrass him later. But when he goes to the party, it's a polka party. Like this, it's perceived as cool to be at a polka party, and nobody knows that he can play accordion really well. And like at some point he like impresses the whole party by like playing this awesome accordion thing, and he becomes a star basically amongst his peers because of it. And so like it gets weirder and weirder, obviously. That gets to the point where like they try to make it sound like he came up with Eat It before Michael Jackson came out with Beat It. just a lot of fun stuff like that. Daniel Radcliffe is really good in this role. I love his post Harry Potter career, because it's just it's basically whatever I want to do, man. I mean, I'm sure he's got all that money saved from Harry Potter and everything, but he can just do any weird thing that he wants to. A Swiss Army Man, no problem, all these just strange movies. But I also like, there's a little cheeky thing too where Rainn Wilson plays his mentor, Dr. Demento. And Rainn Wilson is playing this just like a really crazy dude and everything. And he's talking to Weird Al and saying like, you know, and I won't only be your mentor, I'll be your D-mentor. And he's just like this big, very knowing, like D-mentor. So it's a lot of fun. I would say, it's on the Roku channel, which is, it's free. It's an ads based, thing, just like Tubi is or whatever. So, if you want to add yet another app to your life, you can add this no problem and watch this movie. It's fun. It's a lot of fun. All right. On to the big recommend,
a big one,
which is Go. From 1999.
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Doug Liman is just off of Swingers, which was, I don't know how big of a hit it was. It was an indie hit. I don't know, I'm sure it was profitable, but Swingers like introduced us to a lot of things, like, you know, like swing craze.
Oh yeah, swing revival.
Saying stuff is money is good and stuff like that. This is his first big studio thing, I believe, after he does Swingers. And it's basically sort of playing off of what Pulp Fiction did back in 1994, which was, it takes three somewhat connected stories and then gives different perspectives throughout, even though each story sort of stands on their own. You don't really have to know anything about any one particular story, but each one of them connects in some sort of way. The first one is Rana, played by Sarah Polley, who is a cashier at a grocery store, and she's about to get kicked out of her apartment for not paying rent. And she takes a shift that Simon, The Simon's a terrible person. I don't know if I like Simon or I hate Simon.
I wrote down that Simon is the most likable, unlikable character I've ever seen.
It really is like that.
Because by his last scene, you just like that guy. He's been nothing but a dick the entire movie, but I can't help but like him.
Yeah, exactly. He wants to go to Vegas, so he tries to pawn his shift off on Rana, who does take the shift. And because she takes that shift, she is approached by two semi-famous actors played by Jay Moore and Scott Wolf, asking if they can get some ecstasy, because they usually talk to Simon, but Simon's not there. So Rana says, I can do this. I can get the ecstasy for you. And so they're like, cool. They buy a million like jugs of orange juice and then head out. Rana knows the name of the drug dealer. It's Todd Gaines. And she goes to his place to ask for 20 hits of X. This is one of my favorite scenes in the movie, just because of that Massive Attack song that's playing.
Oh, yeah.
There's a point where she asks for the 20 hits and he turns that volume up all the way. And then you just see him motioning, and she takes off her shirt, and then he tells her to turn around and all that. Yeah. Looking for wires, and then he turns it all the way down. He's like, you asked for 20 hits of X, where 20 hits just so happens to be, you know, trafficking or whatever. And she's like, I, you know, I would never fuck you that way. And he goes, how would you fuck me? And she's really convincing, apparently, because he does give her the 20. I don't even know why he does. Like, I don't know why he does any of the things he does in this
movie. That's true. Really. Yes.
But I love Todd Gaines. I love Timothy Oliphant.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Because there is a point where Simon says, I got it from Todd. He's a nice guy. And Taye Diggs is like, oh yeah, he's the nice drug dealer. He kind of is. It's weird. He kind of is. So she gets the 20 hits of X and goes to sell it to the two actors. And then there's another person that she didn't know was going to be there, played by William Fichtner, who's an undercover cop. And William Fichtner is awesome in this. I don't think we even mentioned him in the cast last week. We should have. William Fichtner is this guy who's basically doing his whole plan is to get the smallest person and then flip that person for a bigger person and flip that person for a bigger person until he gets to the big drug dealer at the end. And he's, you know, it all seems pretty futile. But she goes to sell it to these guys, and things are immediately weird because the details of the story they told at the grocery store, don't match up with what they're saying here. There's a point where William Fichtner goes back to get orange juice and hands her a beer and says, we are all out of orange juice. And then Scott Wolf is like, well, no, we bought a bunch of orange juice. It's out in the car. Let me go get it. She realizes something's not cool right away, and you don't know why she knows completely why it's not good until later, but she goes into the bathroom and flushes the X down the toilet and then sort of like, she's like, talks her way out of the apartment by saying, you know, maybe I shouldn't be here with this beer because, you know, I'm so underage and all. She's playing 17 in this, and that's another aspect of this movie. They had to hire actors who were just a little bit past 18 for this, because they couldn't do half the stuff they do in the movie if it wasn't for that fact. So now she's got a problem. She has flushed the X and she has no money to give the drug dealer anything. So she has in this whole time she has left Katie Holmes, her friend, at Todd's house as collateral. And she comes back and says, I couldn't sell the X. And she replaces the X with like baby aspirin and stuff. Something that will look at least
She just keeps compounding her bad decisions with worse decisions.
It's insane. It's absolutely insane all the way through this. Then it all culminates in this, this Merry Xmas, you know, rave that's going on at this abandoned building and everything. So that's one story. And then there's another story involving the actors, Adam and Zach, and it goes through all their stuff. And then it also has, Simon, who is in the middle of this. Simon's trip to Vegas, which is the craziest trip. You know, it's one of those crazy Vegas stories, basically.
Yeah, it's like The Hangover condensed into 20 minutes.
It pretty much is, yeah. Yeah. Simon goes with his friends, played by Taye Diggs and Breckenmeyer, and that one guy that you've seen a million times, but I can't remember his name right now.
Oh, yeah, the guy who plays Sing.
He was in Independence Day.
Yeah.
I'm going to find this guy's name real quick. Sorry. Yep. Oh God, there he is. James Duvall, who's also in Donnie Darko, who plays
Frank. Yeah.
So they are all in Vegas. They're all in Vegas, going to have a good time. Of course, right off the bat, Breckenmeyer and James Duvall eat the shrimp, even though Taye Diggs told them not to eat the shrimp. And half of their crew is sick in the apartment while Simon and Taye Diggs go and do their thing. Simon loses his money right away and then goes and asks Taye Diggs, you know, hey, can I have some money? And he's like, we've been here for 5 minutes. And he's like, it was a game I was playing, $100 a table. And I didn't know how it worked. And now I do. And I can beat it now. And blah, blah, blah. And Taye Diggs just takes his wallet. But then in the meantime, Simon goes and finds two women at a wedding chapel, and like they go up and get high and they have sex. And there's another scene I love, another soundtrack moment. They play a song from the band Air during this thing where the apartment goes up in flames because they were careless about not stamping out their papers and stuff. Well, actually, it's a papers that the girl was putting in her nose so that she could hold the weed in when she smokes it. She gets on fire and it gets on the carpet and they stamp it out, but then it rekindles after while they're having their threesome and everything. But I love that scene because it's Simon's like there's like two women on him and he's high and he's like looking over and he sees the curtains like engulfed in flames and he's just kind of like smiling at it like, yeah, that's normal. And and then realizes, oh, okay, you know. And then there's like it's immediately like goes down and finds Taye Diggs, and Taye Diggs is getting upset because people keep on they see that he's black and he's wearing this odd coat. So they all think that he works at various places in the casino. So they think he's a bathroom attendant. And then there's another point where they think he's the people who do the car stuff.
The car stuff, the valets
who park cars, valets. They think he's a valet. And they steal this dude's car because he thinks he's a valet, which is weird. I think that's a weird thing to do. Like the one thing is not like the other, but anyway, they steal the car. They find a gun in the car. They go to a strip club. And of course, Taye Diggs is like, you're going to go in there and the one thing you don't want to say is champagne, because that means a private dance and we can't afford that. And like, within seconds of getting two strippers to get to that, she goes, Simon goes, I want to buy your most expensive bottle of champagne. And then, you know, he's told not to touch the strippers when they're dancing. Of course he touches the strippers because he's Simon. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of stuff going on there. And then eventually have to leave. But the thing is, Simon's been using Todd Gaines's credit card this whole time. And of course that means the two guys at the strip club who have some connections with Vegas and everything try to find out where this Todd Gaines lives. And then finally you have the Adam and Zach thing, which is, it turns into this funny thing because they're only doing this thing so that they can get off of this possession charge. And, at the end of it, William Fichtner is like, hey, do you mind coming to my house with my wife and having a Christmas dinner, which is an early Christmas dinner. And they just kind of go along with it because after all, they're in trouble and they might as well do what this cop asks. And but they're pretty much fine. I think they're pretty much off of off of the charge at that point. They go to have dinner and like stuff seems very strange. William Fichtner keeps on telling Jay Moore that he's got like a great body and that, you know, that his abs feel great and all his different things. There's a point where he shows up, he's like completely naked in his house. And he's like, hey, smell this perfume. He doesn't even like acknowledge that he's naked. He's like, smell this cologne. He goes, it smells like CK1, doesn't it? But it's not. And then, and then they go and have the dinner and Jane Krakowski plays his wife. I love Jane Krakowski in this. Jane Krakowski's great. A lot of you know from 30 Rock and Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt and the Flintstones, if you're like go back that far. Everything seems like they're trying to get these two actors to have a big, huge like orgy with them. It's basically what it seems like. But then by the end of it, William Fichtner is like, hey, do you know where we got all these things? And they're like, I don't know, Sears, JCPenney. William Fichtner gives a knowing look to his wife. He's like, all of these things come from Confederated Products. And then they find out that they have all these people underneath them who sell Confederated Products. And they're making $50,000 a month. And they're the fourth highest selling couple in California. And and Jay Moore is like, you just brought us here so that you could sell us some Amway? And the word Amway like triggers them a little bit.
Oh man.
it's Confederated Products. It's a different company. And so he's trying to get these guys because they're trying to recruit. They can't recruit inside the police force. So they're trying to recruit other groups to help sell these things. And then we find out that Jay Moore and Scott Wolfe are in a relationship. They are a gay couple who have been cheating on each other with the same person, and which leads to one of the funniest scenes in the movie when they go to see the guy they're cheating on's roommate, played by Melissa McCarthy, who is just as adorable as can be in this scene. But there's a point where she sees them both there at the thing, and she's like, just. You guys know, right? And they're like, we know. It's like, okay. It's like, it was so exciting. There was this one time where you must have missed each other like by 3 minutes.
It was so exciting.
And then she gives them the thing to the rave. This rave is the centerpiece of a lot of the action that happens in this. And then there's like a side story where Katie Holmes, who's playing the collateral, in this is sort of developing a relationship with the drug dealer Todd Gaines. Todd is just kind of like somewhat entertaining her and you know being an asshole to her and I like this. He asked her if she wants. He's like, you thinking you might want to get laid tonight? And she's like, no. She's like, wait a minute, do you? Yes, you want to get laid, but you know, no, you don't want to get laid, or yes, you want to get laid, but not by me. And then he goes through that whole Breakfast Club thing. Are you a virgin, Claire? Or answer the question, Claire. But I love also this part too, where he's on the phone and he answers these questions. You don't know what the questions are, but then later on, when you see the Simon thing, you hear what Simon asks him over the phone, and you know what the answers to those questions. There's a point where Simon's like, "You gonna fuck her?" And he says, "I don't know, maybe," is what he says, and that's all we hear. We only hear the "I don't know, maybe," at the beginning of that. So, I love this movie. It's progressive in a way, and in another way, it's completely not progressive. It's 1999, so there's some things in it that you probably wouldn't do today. But like, think about the Jay Moore and Scott Wolfe couple. Like, I don't know if we had seen, I don't think we had seen gay couples, like not in a mainstream movie.
right,
played this way before. Like, there's some things that are a little stereotypical about them. Like, they know what wine goes with ham, and they, right. And they know they answer immediately. They have, they squeal when there's, when they're in the car. There's a lot of little things like that, but they don't do the real stereotypical act that right. we had seen for so long in movies in this. It's just funny and entertaining, and it's fun to know, you know, like Sarah Polley has become like a big acclaimed director after this. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, this is, you know, Katie Holmes at her most lovable Katie Holmes. I've told you about that little shoulder move that she does when she's in the diner and she's like, you know, talking to Timothy Oliphant. And I love that little thing that she does with their shoulder when she's doing it. But there's so many scenes. I'm going to let you talk. I've talked way too much at this point. I understand that there's a lot of scenes to get to. So, tell me what you like.
I do love in that diner scene when she says, you know, why I like you. It's not your looks. You're only medium cute. She's just so like blunt, but she's being adorable at the same time. Of course, she tells him he's the least fake person she's met in LA, which kind of rings true because he mm-hmm. doesn't ever appear to be putting on airs for anyone. there's a lot to like here. The Pulp Fiction stuff, I think, really turns up when the guys run Sarah Polley over and mm-hmm. then see Timothy Oliphant with the gun and then run away from the scene. And then that scene where Scott Wolf remembers and finds the freaking microphone wire that he'd had on for the earlier operation. It's like, oh shit. And they're like, well, I love also that scene where Jerry Moore is running through the options. He's like, all right, well, let's just be obvious. She's either dead or she's alive. Mm-hmm. If she's dead, there's nothing we can do about it. If she's alive, that guy with the gun looked like he wanted to shoot her. He probably mm-hmm. still shot her. So, mm-hmm. and then Scott Wolf says, so if she's alive, she's dead.
Yeah.
A lot of really great dialogue exchanges in this movie. I do think William Fichtner is my favorite performance of everyone. He really does put off the exact right kind of creepy, weird vibe that you might assume was sexual. It's even that scene on the mattress where he's like, I could do aerobics right here on the side of the bed and you'd never feel it. And Jay Moore's like, I bet I would. and then you mentioned it already, but my very favorite moment in the entire movie is when Jay Moore says Amway and we just see William Fichtner's expression because he is so, there's so much history and baggage there. Yeah. And he is so over it. You feel like he's going to snap one of these days when somebody says that to him and get violent. I love that all three stories start in the grocery store within the first 6 minutes, even though we do separate into three distinct sections. Simon is there, Rana is there, and the guys are there all in the first 6 minutes of that first section. I love how the intersections work. It's LA, but they justify it, I think, that, you know, Timothy Oliphant would be able to track down Sarah Polley, and everybody's at that rave for a justifiable reason, I think. It's just so high adrenaline. I enjoyed it more every time I've seen it. This is probably my fourth or fifth viewing. I hadn't seen it in maybe 10 years or more.
Mm-hmm.
The music is great all through the movie, but that magic carpet ride hit when his car comes flying out of the ramp from the parking garage is just one of the best musical cues.
It's so perfect.
And it's right before that, there's this it's like this lean is into it with sound effects.
They build it so well because they're running from those, they're trying to drive away from those guys in that big ass truck of theirs, and they get behind this long, like, you know, line with the little lever thing, and Simon just like, all right, you know what, we're just going to go through the entrance instead. Of course, there's a car coming through the entrance at the time, but that's, you know, screw it, we're trying to get away from these guys. And they get out and like go up that, you know, they go up that ramp, and you're like, oh my God, they're doing this. And then yes, boom, I like to dream.
I think the scene with Simon at the end, where, okay, so first of all, the gangsters show up, and they're already there waiting for Todd when Todd and Claire get back, because they're going to have sex. And I think any other movie would have let that confrontation play out. But this movie skips it entirely and goes straight to after they've sorted it out. And Timothy Olyphant has said, okay, his apartment is right here on the corner of the street, on the second floor. And it just creates a laugh that you wouldn't get if you actually watched the whole conflict and exchange playing out. And then I want to know your opinion on whether or not you think that gunshot was accidental or if Simon actually got shot in the arm, because the movie doesn't tell us. We just hear him yell, "I'm okay." And Katie Holmes is in the hallway. Do we know for sure if that dude shot Simon in the arm? Do you have an opinion?
I think he probably did. I think that's how it ended up. I don't think it was accidental. Maybe it was, but I've always assumed that he finally got the courage, or the other dude ended up just shooting him himself, or, you know, whatever, you know, just to get it done, because it's gone on long enough. But yeah, that's all right. I'm okay. we didn't even mention the character of Manny, who complicates a lot of this too. He's played by Nathan Bexton. He has a couple of moments in this that I love too, where the movie really goes kind of like in its off the rail sections, because he's taken two of those hits, and we've already been established from Todd himself, like, just sell one of these to one person. Don't sell them two, or else they're going to be at the ambulance and they're going to go into the hospital and their brain's going to be fried. And so just before Ronna goes in to sell the X to Scott Wolf and Jay Moore, he's pocketed two of those for himself, and he pops them both at the same time. In the early part of the movie, they're doing this death celebrity game, where they have to come up with the name of a dead celebrity that starts with the last name of the last person. They mention Omar Sharif, who was alive at the time. But Omar Sharif gets to all the way to this point where somebody says Malcolm X, and somebody's like, there's a debate as to whether you can use Malcolm X or not. And then there's like, well, who could possibly start with X? Like, who's a celebrity who starts with X? And like, there's this whole thing, like Scott Wolf says something like Xerxes, I believe, is what he comes up with later on, when they're having the debate even out there in the actual grocery store and everything. So we've forgotten all about that. And then this guy on all this X goes in to Todd's apartment.
It's Todd's apartment.
And there's a cat that Todd has that comes up and just kind of like walks up to him, and all of a sudden it's like things get weird, and it's like you hear this and this music and everything, and like you can see the subtitles where it says, "I can read your thoughts." The cat's reading his thoughts, and he's like, then suddenly he just like comes up with this Zhang Shi Ching or something like that name or whatever, and it's a celebrity that starts with X, and Manny's looking at the cat like, what? And he's like, well, actually no, it starts with a CH or whatever, it's not X. And then he goes, "You're going to die." So and Manny has another scene in the grocery store where a woman, or he's fantasizing that the woman at the checkout is dancing with him, and they're dancing to this like sped up version of Macarena during this whole thing, and this is going on, and like Sarah Polley comes up to him, and she's like, "What are you?" He's just sitting there like just kind of like in a daze. Nothing has happened. There's no dancing that has gone on at all. So yeah, Manny's pretty funny in this too. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. There's so many things in this movie. It's one after another. It's just nothing but things happening all the way through. There's no slow point. There's no slow point.
You can't look away or you'll miss something.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, go. I hope a lot of you guys out there liked Go as well. Hopefully when we're giving you this homework, we're giving you the stuff that you really, really enjoy. So anyway, Jeremy, what do you think would be a good double feature for Go?
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I'll tell you what, the first third of this movie, I thought, am I going to be able to choose anything except Pulp Fiction? But the more the movie went on, the more I started to see more attributes and traits and themes that I could apply the double feature concept to. I thought for a long time about City of God, but I think ultimately City of God has too much important stuff to say, even though it's very funny at times and it is about kids dabbling in crime and it getting away from them. I think it's more dramatic at times. So I tried to lean towards the comedy. I took a step towards Suicide Kings for a little bit because part of me wanted to pick another movie that's set all in one night. And I wanted multiple stories. That was really what I came down
to. Jay Moore in that movie? Suicide Kings?
Yeah, he's in Suicide Kings.
Yeah. I was like, yeah.
That would be a little on the nose. So,
yeah.
And now I'm going to cheat. I'm going to give you a total of four because I'm one of the co-hosts of the show. I was settled on Superbad for a long time, but it just felt like it was missing some similarities. And now I'm going to give you the double feature, which is not a great movie. And it's The Night Before.
It stars
Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Anthony Mackie and Seth Rogen. And they're trying to get to, I believe it's even a Christmas weed party. And they get separated and they all have misadventures. One of them, Seth Rogen, takes all the drugs and ends up in church really high, and a baby starts talking to him and making faces at him. and so there were too many, it all takes place over one night, too many similarities. So I think that would be an excellent double feature. I would start with The Night Before so that everyone's palate could be cleansed by Go, because The Night Before has some laughs, but it's not solid all the way through, in my opinion. But I do think it is a really good choice for a double feature here.
I do too. I think this is absolutely excellent double feature choice. It works perfectly. I haven't seen The Night Before in a while, but it does have that same sort of dynamic for sure. So
yeah,
really, really good.
All right.
So anyway, what is the movie you have picked for the homework next week?
I'm excited about this. I have picked for next week's homework a 2008 martial arts film called Ip Man.
Ooh.
Starring Donnie Yen.
Yeah.
This is a fictionalized, dramatized account of the man who trained Bruce Lee. That's who Ip Man is. I fell in love with Donnie Yen watching Iron Monkey. Iron Monkey is pretty much a straight comedy.
Yeah.
But he gives a very charming performance there. Then when I saw Ip Man, I realized what a martial artist he is. Mm-hmm. And most of the movie, he's using some really elegant techniques and movements. It's ballet-like, his fighting style. But there's one scene in particular where he gets brutal, and it's one of my favorite scenes of all time. And basically, it's your straightforward older martial arts teacher gets dragged into this turf war with these big organizations that are trying to cut down the poor people. And it's one man against everyone. Mm-hmm. If you have not seen this, I can't wait to hear what you guys think. This is free everywhere. You can watch it on Peacock for free. It's on Tubi for free. Roku channel, Redbox, Crackle, Amazon. It's free.
Plex. Wow.
Netflix, you can watch it for free on YouTube. So there's no excuse. I mean, other than time, there's no financial excuse for not being able to watch Ip Man from 2008 before next week's show. So that's your homework for next week.
Awesome. I can't wait to dive back into that one.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites of all time. There are like four or five Ip Man movies. The second one's pretty good.
I've got I think it's a steelbook with three of those movies. I don't know if it's all, I don't know if it's all of them, but it's got at least three, I believe. So,
Anyway, we got some time for questions.
All right, let's do some questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the
truth.
I am listening.
Let's do some questions. Any questions? What are your favorite facial expressions in movies? By that, I mean non-dialogue moments where a character conveys things with a look, like Harrison Ford in The Fugitive, in The Interrogation, or Steve Carell's look on the poster for 40-Year-Old Virgin.
There's a scene in Everything Everywhere All at Once where at the end of the movie, and I don't... This is a semi-spoiler for this movie. If you haven't seen Everything Everywhere All at Once, I guess forward through this part, and if you're out there listening live, you know, just don't listen for the next 30 seconds or so. But there's a scene at the end, like there's a discussion as to whether they should tell the grandfather that, you know, that the character, that Joy is in a lesbian relationship with this woman what's her name, plays the actress name, oh, Becky. It's played Becky, played by Tally Midell. And there's a point where at the end, Michelle Yeoh tells the grandfathers, like, this is Becky. This is her girlfriend. This is her girlfriend. After she just said that this was her good friend earlier in the movie. And so there's a whole bunch of stuff that happens that gets back to the scene. And the grandfather's like, girlfriend. And like says this to Becky, says, girlfriend. And Becky goes through about three different emotions all at once. She's like smiling, and then her eyes get up and well up and was about to cry, and then she's like, what did he say? And it tears me up every time I see it. It's so good, the range of emotion she shows all in that. But that's the stuff leading up to before she says what did he say always gets me. There's also the scene in Frequency where Andre Brower has been told, he's been told all these details about that Mets World Series in 1969. And he doesn't believe anything about, oh yeah, you're talking to your son in the future and all this other stuff. He doesn't believe any of that stuff. And Jim Caviezel has told Dennis Quaid, here's exactly what's going to happen in this game. And then later on, Dennis Quaid relays that to Andre Brower. Andre Brower is in a cafe, and they're at a point where they basically, you know, they don't believe anything he says or anything. And he hears the exact play-by-play going on that happens. And Andre Brower puts on this face he just realized that this story is true, and he doesn't have to say a word. He just has to give this agape smile this solves everything, you know. So that I've always loved that. I haven't seen Frequency in forever, but that's one of the things that I remember about that movie so much is that Andre Brower expression.
Andre Brower is another one of our like best actors who doesn't get the press. My answer is in Star Trek Beyond, the Enterprise crashes and blows up, which actually happens in every other Star Trek movie, but they're stranded on this planet, but as it turns out, the leader of these bad guys on this planet is a former Starfleet guy, and wouldn't you know it, his ship didn't crash. It somehow got stuck in this mountain phase shifter thing. And so they have a starship that they can use to go home, but they don't have any way to build the thrust they need to break free of the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And John Cho, who's a pilot, gives them this detailed idea to push the thing off the top of the cliff and let it fall straight down face first. And that will provide the momentum to essentially jumpstart this space vehicle, to give it enough thrust. And so they do it. They push they push the starship off the thing. It goes down. It does the classic movie thing where it disappears below and you don't see it. And then it comes roaring back up over with thrusters on. And it cuts to John Cho turning to his right. And he makes this face that says, I honestly didn't know that was going to work. Mm-hmm. And he does it with a look of like, it's mixed with pride and surprise and relief. And it is my biggest laugh in the entire movie is that freaking facial expression. I love John Cho. We got a lot of good answers here.
Yeah. Josh says Liam Neeson at the end of The Gray.
That's a good one.
Mm-hmm. Tombstone when Val Kilmer winks. That's from Shaggy Nuts. Shaggy Nuts, everybody. Yeah. I've said it before. I'll say it again. Mm-hmm. JC says Interstellar has a moment where there's dialogue, but Matthew McConaughey doesn't say a word. Yeah, I guess the scene where he sees Jessica Chastain, his grown-up daughter. I don't know if it's the same thing he's thinking about there, but that cry scene, which of course was memed to death, but is really great scene in the movie.
Yeah, it is.
James says Knives Chow's square-eyed faced halfway through Scott Pilgrim as Aces. Brad Pitt's expression for the what's in the box scene in Seven. Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah.
Yeah. Lakeith Stanfield in Get Out when he wakes up for a moment. Yeah. It has about four emotions he shows in his face without saying anything. Yep. Yeah. God, there's a lot here. Thanks guys. A lot of stuff on that one. We have time for maybe one more.
Yeah, we do. What is one of your most recent times you were watching a film and you saw a super young version of a famous person in it?
I had not seen Dark Knight Rises in forever. So the first time I watched Dark Knight Rises, I did not know who Joey King was at all.
Oh yeah.
And then later on, you know, like now that she's had this huge body of work, I think since 2013, you know, she's become super recognizable. And so like in the movie where she's kind of an anonymous person and everything, you don't know who she is. Like I saw her in Dark Knight Rises and I got really excited. I was like, oh yeah, she's playing Talia or whatever. Yeah. That was fun. And then Skylar Gazzando, an Amazing Spider-Man, plays one of Dennis Leary's kids in that scene. Skylar Gazzando, who we've seen in stuff like Booksmart and was in what's the show with Timothy Oliphant and Drew Barrymore in it. My brain's
Santa
not
Clarita.
Yeah, Santa Clarita Diet. Yeah, is that one. You've seen him and stuff like that. And he just has this very small like cutaway scene in that Dennis Leary thing. And I was like, oh, there's that dude, but he's like a baby in this.
I was watching A River Runs Through It. This is a few years back now, and had no idea that Joseph Gordon-Levitt had been in that movie but also had been acting at it's one of the early scenes when the brothers are young. He looks like he's 6 years old. I tweeted out about it at the time because I don't think I came across Joseph Gordon-Levitt until maybe Third Rock from the Sun, Angels in the Outfield, maybe before that. But he'd been acting since 1988. Also 1988, last week I talked about the movie Colors, a 1988 movie, and Mario Lopez is in that, Saved by the Bell fame, and he's pretty young.
Oh yeah.
Chat's got some good ones.
Yeah, the Ashley Johnson and Wings. Yeah, the thing is about Ashley Johnson, if you're of Jeremy and I, we saw Ashley Johnson a long time ago in Growing Pains.
Yeah,
it was weirder to see her in like as a full-grown adult in Spider-Man. It's one of the
Avengers.
The Avengers, that's right. Yeah. It was the crazy thing to me was like, whoa, she's like super grown up now. I've always seen her as a little kid and growing thing. Let's see what else. Oh, and Christian Bale in Empire of the Sun. Yeah.
Oh
yeah. That's cool. A good one. So Josh says Joshua Jackson in The Changeling. That's a joke. Yep. That's a callback to The Changeling, which is it's weird that he's listed as a possible like uncredited extra in that movie. And same though. Alden Ehrenreich in season one of Supernatural. And Kristen Stewart in Panic Room. Of course, we had seen Kristen. That was where people like us who were old saw Kristen Stewart for the first time. So it was one of those. But I imagine if you're of a certain age and you started seeing Kristen Stewart first, like in Twilight and things like that, and moved on to her older roles, and then you went back and saw Panic Room, you'd be like, "Whoa, that's like baby Kristen Stewart there."
Yeah, or Zathura, or even Jumper.
Yeah, Zathura. Yeah. And then, yeah, it's not crazy, but I always forget Seth Rogen is in Donnie Darko. That's what says. Yeah, absolutely. Seth Rogen is a baby Seth Rogen in that. He's like 17 or 18 years old in that movie, I think.
Yep.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Next week is going to be Eat Man. I can't wait to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, thanks a lot, guys, for coming out in the chat and giving in your 2 cents and everything. Appreciate it quite a bit that you guys come in every week and give us comments. So,
you're welcome.
Yeah, that's going to do it for this episode. We will see you next time. See ya.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
I can see far away perfectly, but menus and text on screen that's close to my face, I'm starting to struggle with.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like I'm having to wear these glasses more and more, which I feel like that means my eyesight's getting worse and worse.
Yeah,
probably happens.
Probably is. Age. Yeah, I mean, that's from what I understand. That's just the way it goes.
I was reading. Okay, so yesterday I saw this story about, and there was photos about John Mayer on a dinner date with Kiernan Shipka.
Okay.
She's 22. He's 40-something, 45?
I think he was born my year, so he'd be 45.
Okay, so I'm not interested in the age gap.
I'm not either.
Do whatever you want if you're an adult. But within the story was the sentences that said they left a few minutes apart in their own vehicles, but two blocks away, she got into his limo, where she remained until she was dropped off at her home. And I'm like, they fucking followed that girl from the restaurant two blocks away to see if she got in John Mayer's car, mm-hmm. and then followed that limo all the way to her house.
Yeah.
Like, being a celebrity must suck ass.
Oh, and also, who's being creepy now, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you think the age gap is creepy, but you're the one literally following around. I couldn't find a way to tweet about it. That wouldn't probably invite speculation on the age gap.
I think we definitely would all be better off not knowing what the comings and goings of every single person, everywhere they go, and then having them have to try to figure out how, you know, do that spy trick where they change cars and all sorts of stuff to try to get away from everybody. You know, it's just kind of, I don't know why people are interested in it.
I mean, not the details. I mean, I get why people like the gossip, and it comes a certain point where regular citizens stop seeing celebrities as human beings. We just see them as, oh, well, you're rich, so you can endure this shit.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're famous, so you must be all right with all of this.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't imagine. I can't imagine, like, having to have a game plan. Like, they clearly planned to try and end up in the same vehicle without anybody knowing, they were just followed. Maybe she was being followed and felt unsafe, and that's why she got in his car. I don't know. I just feel like the paparazzi is probably one of the biggest evils that we just kind of overlook.
Yeah, we do.
And they've been doing it for decades and decades.
Mm-hmm.
Because the people got to know what outfit the people were wearing when they went for Dunkin' Donuts.
Right.
I also love how anytime a female celebrity has any part of her stomach showing, the headline now is shows off her abs, or like there's some kind of intent behind.
Yeah.
Like maybe she just pulled on a shirt that felt comfortable. I mean, it's just everything gets, intent is being put into headlines about celebrities where it doesn't need to be.
Well, I mean, you know, that Princess Diana thing,
right,
tells you how silly people are about every little thing. Like, well, she went out there mainly for the publicity. Like, everybody's just like, where? And I'm sitting there just going, where did you get that? Where has she ever like stated that she loves going out because to be seen or anything like that? Or was, you know, you like, can people just not be going out to help people like they say they're going to, or going out to just go get groceries?
It's like we read into body language. Body language expert says Ben Affleck is miserable in new marriage.
Yeah.
I'm like, dude, maybe he just found out his dog died when you took that picture. Why don't you shut the fuck up?
Yeah, exactly.
It's all just to sell more clicks and ads, and nobody gives a shit about anyone's feelings.
I know.
Anyway, I appreciate that you and I care about people's feelings.
Yeah.
For the most part. There may be one or two people whose feelings we don't care about.
There's some people we just don't.
That was earned. Yeah, it's Tennessee. This may be the last time I get to vote, though, so I want to exercise that right.
That's true. That's true. It might be the last time. Good times.
I mean, I'm joking, but that does feel like a possible future.